So this next sutta carries on from the previous ones of that were sort of the Dhamma in brief. Well, this is not so brief, but it is sort of like an overview of what is in accordance with Dhamma and what is not. this is Anguttara 8, sutta number 30. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bagga people near Sungsumaragiri in the deer park of the Besakala Grove. At that time, the Venerable Anuruddha dwelt among the Jetis in the eastern bamboo grove. While living there alone and secluded, these reflections occurred to him. This Dhamma is for one of few wishes, not for one with many wishes. This Dhamma is for the contented, not for the discontented. This Dhamma is for the secluded, not for one who loves company. This Dhamma is for the energetic, not for the indolent. This Dhamma is for one of vigilant mindfulness, not for one of lax mindfulness. This Dhamma is for one with a concentrated mind, not for one who is unconcentrated. This Dhamma is for the wise, not for one without wisdom. Now the Blessed One became aware of the Venerable Anuruddha's reflections, and as speedily as a strong man might stretch his bent arm or bend his stretched arm, he disappeared from the deer park at the Besakala Grove and appeared before the Venerable Anuruddha in the eastern bamboo grove. When the Blessed One had sat down in the seat prepared for him, the Venerable Anuruddha paid homage to him and sat down to one side. Then the Blessed One addressed him thus, "Good Anuruddha, good, you have reflected well on the seven thoughts of a great person, namely, this Dhamma is for one of few wishes, not for one of many wishes. This Dhamma is for the contented, not for the discontented. This Dhamma is for the secluded, not for one who loves company. This Dhamma is for the energetic, not for the indolent. This Dhamma is for one of vigilant mindfulness, not for one of lax mindfulness. This Dhamma is for one with a concentrated mind, not for one who is unconcentrated. This Dhamma is for the wise, not for one without wisdom. But, Anuruddha, you may further reflect on this eighth thought of a great person, namely, this Dhamma is for one who delights in the unworldly, who rejoices in the unworldly, not for one who delights and rejoices in worldliness." And that translation, worldly and unworldly, unworldly is nipapancha, and worldliness is papancha. Papancha signifies the expansion, differentiation, diffuseness and manifoldness of the world, and it may also refer to the phenomenal world in general and the mental attitude of worldliness. It is in the last mentioned two senses that this term and its opposite, nipapancha, have been rendered here and in the concluding verses of this text. In his important book Concept and Reality, Bhikkhu Nyanananda adds to the above-mentioned connotations the meaning conceptual proliferation, which provides the key for understanding the term when it occurs in a psychological context, as it often does in the suttas. However, it seems improbable that its meaning applies to our present text, which Tanjef, in his translation, translates it as complication. So this Dhamma is for one who delights in non-complication, who rejoices in non-complication, not for one who delights and rejoices in complication, which I actually prefer. It makes it psychological. Because he's following the commentaries. Commentaries almost certainly say that. They tend to... That'll most likely be the case, I would think. He tends to follow the commentaries much more rigorously than say Tanjeff does. That being from Sri Lanka, the commentary tradition has a very strong importance, plays a very big role. Yeah, everything else. They're all about internal qualities. As I read it through, I'll actually use complication and non-complication, but I thought I'd put it out there that is what is one. I mean, Bhikkhu Bodhi is a pretty stellar translator, so that there's enough strong enough feeling for him to do it. Translated in that way. Okay. When reflecting on those eight thoughts of a great person, Anuruddha, you may, while secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, whenever you wish, enter and dwell in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thought and examination, with rapture and happiness born of seclusion. With the subsiding of thought and examination, you may, whenever you wish, enter and dwell in the second jhana, which has internal confidence and unification of mind, is without thought and examination, and has rapture and happiness born of concentration. With the fading away as well of rapture, you may, whenever you wish, dwell equanimous, and, mindful and clearly comprehending, experiencing happiness with the body, you may enter and dwell in the third jhana, of which the noble ones declare, he is equanimous, mindful, one who dwells happily. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous passing away of joy and sadness, you may, whenever you wish, enter and dwell in the fourth jhana, which is neither painful nor pleasant, and includes the purification of mindfulness by equanimity. When you reflect upon those eight thoughts of a great person and attain, whenever you wish, without difficulty and trouble, those four jhanas which pertain to the higher mind, pleasant dwellings in this very life, then, Anuruddha, your rag robe will seem to you as his chest full of colored garments seems to a householder or his son. And for you who live contentedly, your rag robe will serve for your joy, for your unperturbed life, for your well-being, and as an aid for entering Nibbana. Then, Anuruddha, your scraps of alms food will seem to you as his dish of rice, cleaned of black grains, and served with many gravies and curries, seems to a householder or his son. And for you who live contentedly, your alms food scraps will serve for your joy, for your unperturbed life, for your well-being, and as an aid for entering Nibbana. Then, Anuruddha, your abode under a tree will seem to you as his gabled mansion, plastered inside and out, draft-free, with bolts fastened and shutters closed, seems to a householder or a son. And for you who live contentedly, your tree abode will serve for your joy, for your unperturbed life, for your well-being, and as an aid for entering Nibbana. Then, Anuruddha, your bed and seat made of straw will seem to you as to a householder or a son, his couch seems covered with a long fleeced and black woolen rug, or a bedspread of white wool, a coverlet decorated with flowers, spread over with an exquisite antelope skin, having a canopy overhead and scarlet cushions at both ends. And for you who live contentedly, your straw spread will serve for your joy, for your unperturbed life, for your well-being, and as an aid for entering Nibbana. Then, Anuruddha, your medicine of fermented cow's urine will seem to you as to a householder or a son seem his various remedies of butter, ghee, oil, honey, and cane sugar. And for you who live contentedly, your medicine of cow's urine will serve for your joy, for your unperturbed life, for your well-being, and as an aid for entering Nibbana. Therefore, Anuruddha, you may also spend the coming rainy season here in this eastern bamboo grove among the jetis. Yes, Lord, replied the Venerable Anuruddha. And the Blessed One, having admonished the Venerable Anuruddha with this exhortation, as speedily as a strong man might stretch his bent arm or bend his stretched arm, then disappeared from the eastern bamboo grove and reappeared at Sung Sumaragiri in the deer park of the Besa Kala Grove. There the Blessed One sat down on a seat prepared for him and addressed the monks as follows. I will declare to you, O monks, the 8 thoughts of a great person. Listen to them and attend carefully. I shall speak. What are these 8 thoughts of a great person? This Dhamma is for one of few wishes, not for one with many wishes. This Dhamma is for the contented, not for the discontented. This Dhamma is for the secluded, not for one who loves company. This Dhamma is for the energetic, not for the indolent. This Dhamma is for one of vigilant mindfulness, not for one of lax mindfulness. This Dhamma is for one with a concentrated mind, not for one who is unconcentrated. This Dhamma is for the wise, not for one without wisdom. This Dhamma is for one who delights in non-complication, who rejoices in non-complication, not for one who delights and rejoices in complication. But why, monks, was it said? This Dhamma is for one of few wishes, not for one with many wishes. Here, monks, though a monk may be of few wishes, he does not wish to be known as one of few wishes. Though contented, he does not wish to be known as being contented. Though secluded, he does not wish to be known as being secluded. Though energetic, he does not wish to be known as being energetic. Though mindful, he does not wish to be known as being mindful. Though of concentrated mind, he does not wish to be known as one of concentrated mind. Though wise, he does not wish to be known as wise. Though delighting and rejoicing in non-complication, he does not wish to be known as one who delights and rejoices in non-complication. When it was said, this Dhamma is for one of few wishes, not for one with many wishes, it is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said? This Dhamma is for the contented, not for the discontented. Here, monks, a monk is contented with any kind of robe, alms food, lodging, and medicinal requisites. It is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said? This Dhamma is for the secluded, not for one who loves company. Here, monks, while a monk lives secluded, visitors come, monks and nuns, male and female lay followers, kings and their ministers, sectarians and their disciples. Then the monk, with his mind bent on seclusion, leaning towards seclusion, inclined towards seclusion, abiding in seclusion, and delighting in renunciation, speaks to them only in a way tending to dismiss them. It is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said, this Dhamma is for the energetic, not for the indolent? Here, monks, a monk lives with energy, set upon the abandoning of everything unwholesome and the acquiring of everything wholesome. He is steadfast and strong in his effort, not shirking his task in regard to wholesome qualities. It is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said, this Dhamma is for one of vigilant mindfulness, not for one of lax mindfulness? Here, monks, a monk is mindful, equipped with the keenest mindfulness and circumspection. He remembers well and keeps in mind what has been said and done long ago. It is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said, this Dhamma is for one with a concentrated mind, not for one unconcentrated? Here, monks, a monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, the second, the third, the fourth jhana. It is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said, this Dhamma is for the wise, not for one without wisdom? Here, monks, a monk is wise in this way. He is equipped with that wisdom which sees into the rise and fall of phenomena, which is noble and penetrative, leading to the complete destruction of suffering. It is for this reason that this was said. And why was it said? This Dhamma is for one who delights and rejoices in non-complication, not for one who delights and rejoices in complication. Here, monks, a monk's mind urges him on towards the cessation of the world's diffuseness. He is pleased by it, confirmed in it, and liberated. It is for this reason that this was said. And in the coming rainy season, too, the Venerable Anuruddha lived among the Jetis in the eastern bamboo grove, and the Venerable Anuruddha lived alone and secluded, diligent, ardent, and resolute, soon realized here and now by his own direct knowledge That unsurpassed goal of the holy life for the sake of which sons of good family rightly go forth from home to the homeless life. And entering upon it, he dwelt therein. And he knew, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more for this world. And the Venerable Aniruddha had become one of the Arahants. At the time of reaching Arahantship, the Venerable Aniruddha spoke these verses. The Master, peerless in this world, knew my thoughts and came to me, with a body made by mind. He came to me by psychic power. He taught me more than I knew, more than my thoughts contained. The Buddha, cherishing non-complication, taught me about the non-complicated state. And having learned his Dhamma thus, I live delighted in his teaching. I have gained the threefold knowledge. I have done the Master's bidding. Okay, the next sutta is Anguttara 6, sutta number 50. And this is getting things in order. And the sutta is titled here, Step by Step. If there is no sense control, O monks, then the basis for virtue is destroyed for one who lacks sense control. If there is no virtue, then the basis for right concentration is destroyed for one who lacks virtue. If there is no right concentration, then the basis for knowledge and vision of things as they really are is destroyed for one who lacks right concentration. If there is no knowledge and vision of things as they really are, then the basis for disenchantment and dispassion is destroyed for one who lacks such knowledge and vision. If there is no disenchantment and dispassion, then the basis for the knowledge and vision of liberation is destroyed for one who lacks disenchantment and dispassion. This is like a tree without branches and foliage. The buds will not mature, nor will the bark, the greenwood, and the heartwood mature. Similarly, if sense control is absent, there will be no basis for virtue. And so on through all of those again. But if there is sense control, O monks, virtue will have a basis for one who possesses sense control. If there is virtue, right concentration will have a basis for one who possesses virtue. If there is right concentration, knowledge and vision of things as they really are will have a basis for one who possesses right concentration. If there is knowledge and vision of things as they really are, disenchantment and dispassion will have a basis for one who possesses such knowledge and vision of things as they really are. If there is disenchantment and dispassion, the knowledge and vision of liberation will have a basis for one who possesses disenchantment and dispassion. This is like a tree with branches and foliage intact. The buds will mature, and so also the bark, the greenwood, and the heartwood will mature. Similarly, if sense control is present, this will provide a basis for virtue, and so on through for knowledge and vision of liberation. Okay, the next sutta is a part of the Devadaha Sutta, Sutta 101, Minna Majjhima Nikaya, from 23 through to 38. And again, it's just coming back to the aspects of exertion, effort, energy, putting forth of effort. And how is exertion fruitful, bhikkhus? How is striving fruitful? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is not overwhelmed by suffering and does not overwhelm himself with suffering. And he does not give up the pleasure that accords with Dhamma. Yet he is not infatuated with that pleasure. He knows thus, when I strive with determination, this particular source of suffering fades away in me because of that determined striving. And when I look on with equanimity, this particular source of suffering fades away in me when I develop equanimity. He strives with determination in regard to that particular source of suffering which fades away in him because of that determined striving. And he develops equanimity in regard to that particular source of suffering which fades away in him while he is developing equanimity. When he strives with determination, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him because of that determined striving. Thus that suffering is exhausted in him. When he looks on with equanimity, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him while he develops equanimity. Thus that suffering is exhausted in him. Suppose, bhikkhus, a man loved a woman with his mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. He might see that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What do you think, bhikkhus? Would not sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in that man when he sees that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man loves that woman with his mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. That is why sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair would arise in him when he sees her standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. Then, bhikkhus, the man might think, I love this woman with my mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. Thus sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in me when I see her standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What if I were to abandon my desire and lust for that woman? He would abandon his desire and lust for that woman. On a later occasion, he might see that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What do you think, bhikkhus? Would sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise in that man when he sees that woman standing with another man? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that man no longer loves that woman. That is why sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair do not arise in him when he sees that woman standing with another man. So too, bhikkhus. When a bhikkhu is not overwhelmed by suffering and does not overwhelm himself with suffering, and goes through those permutations, thus that suffering is exhausted in him. Thus, bhikkhus, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu considers thus, while I live according to my pleasure, unwholesome states increase in me and wholesome states diminish. But when I exert myself in what is painful, unwholesome states diminish in me and wholesome states increase. What if I exert myself in what is painful? He exerts himself in what is painful. When he does so, unwholesome states diminish in him and wholesome states increase. At a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. Why is that? The purpose for which that bhikkhu exerted himself in what is painful has been achieved. That is why, at a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. Suppose, bhikkhus, an arrowsmith were warming and heating an arrow shaft between two flames, making it straight and workable. When the arrow shaft had been warmed and heated between the two flames and had been made straight and workable, then at a later time he would not again warm and heat the arrow shaft and make it straight and workable. Why is that? The purpose for which that arrowsmith had warmed and heated the arrow and made it straight and workable has been achieved. That is why at a later time he would not again warm and heat the arrow shaft and make it straight and workable. So too, a bhikkhu considers thus, as just above, that is why at a later time he does not exert himself in what is painful. Thus too, bhikkhus, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Again, bhikkhus, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened, and all those qualities of the Buddha, and then going through the eliminating of the five hindrances, and putting effort to do that. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Thus too, bhikkhus, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. And all through the striving and exertion is put forward to realizing the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, and then the three knowledges up to knowledge of the liberation from the taints. So striving is fruitful.
Yeah. In the second jhana, does it say anything about internal confidence? And do you remember the word, the Pali word for internal confidence?
How he translates it as self-confidence. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. But I don't know what the word is in Pali, not being. It'd be easy to find out. Okay. I'd like to read a few suttas on the sort of reminders of putting forth the effort to understand the Four Noble Truths. This is Saṅyutta 56, Sutta number 3. Bhikkhus, whatever clansmen in the past rightly went forth from the household life into homelessness, all did so in order to make the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths as they really are. Whatever clansmen in the future will rightly go forth from the household life into homelessness, all will do so in order to make the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths as they really are. Whatever clansmen at present have rightly gone forth from the household life into homelessness, all have done so in order to make the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths as they really are. What for? The noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. There's Sutta number 33 from Saṅyutta 56. These are all these. Next few are going to be from Saṅyutta 56. Bhikkhus, just as a stick thrown up into the air falls now on its bottom, now on its top, so too, as beings roam and wander on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving, now they go from this world to the other world, now they go from the other world to this world. For what reason? Because they have not seen the Four Noble Truths. What for? The noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Sutta number 34. Bhikkhus, if one's clothes or head were ablaze, what should be done about it? Venerable sir, if one's clothes or head were ablaze, to extinguish one's blazing clothes or head, one should arouse extraordinary desire, make an extraordinary effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and clear comprehension. Bhikkhus, one might look on equanimously at one's blazing clothes or head, paying no attention to them. But so long as one has not made the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths as they really are, in order to make the breakthrough, one should arouse extraordinary desire, make an extraordinary effort, stir up zeal and enthusiasm, be unremitting, and exercise mindfulness and clear comprehension. And what for? Of course, the noble truth of suffering, and so on. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. and exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Next one is Sutta number 41. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Rajagaha, in the bamboo grove, the squirrel sanctuary. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, once in the past a certain man set out from Rajagaha and went to the Sumagada lotus pond, thinking, 'I will reflect about the world.' He then sat down on the bank of the Sumagada lotus pond, reflecting about the world. Then, bhikkhus, the man saw a four-division army entering a lotus stalk on the bank of the pond. Having seen this, he thought, 'I must be mad, I must be insane. I've seen something that doesn't exist in the world.' The man returned to the city and informed a great crowd of people. 'I must be mad, sirs, I must be insane. I've seen something that doesn't exist in the world.' They said to him, 'But how is it, good man, that you are mad? How are you insane? And what have you seen that doesn't exist in the world?' 'Here, sirs, I left Rajagaha and approached the Sumagada lotus pond. I saw a four-division army entering a lotus stalk on the bank of the pond. That's why I'm mad. That's why I'm insane. And that's why I've seen what doesn't exist in the world.' 'Surely you're mad, good man. Surely you're insane. And what you've seen doesn't exist in the world.' 'Nevertheless, bhikkhus, what that man saw was actually real, not unreal. Once in the past, the Devas and the Asuras were arrayed for battle. In that battle, the Devas won and the Asuras were defeated. In their defeat, the Asuras were frightened and entered the Asura city through the lotus stalk to the bewilderment of the Devas. Therefore, bhikkhus, do not reflect about the world thinking, the world is eternal, or the world is not eternal, or the world is finite, or the world is infinite, or the soul and body are the same, or the soul is one thing, the body is another, the Tathagata exists after death, or the Tathagata does not exist after death, or the Tathagata both exist and does not exist after death, or the Tathagata neither exists nor does not exist after death. For what reason? Because, bhikkhus, this reflection is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. When you reflect, bhikkhus, you should reflect. This is suffering. You should reflect. This is the origin of suffering. You should reflect. This is the cessation of suffering. You should reflect. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. For what reason? Because, bhikkhus, this reflection is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And the last reading on the Four Noble Truths is Sutta number 35. Bhikkhus, suppose there were a man with a lifespan of 100 years. Who could live 100 years? Someone would say to him, "Come, good man. In the morning they will strike you with 100 spears. At noon they will strike you with 100 spears. In the evening they will strike you with 100 spears. And you, good man, being struck day after day by 300 spears, will have a lifespan of 100 years, will live 100 years. And then, after 100 years have passed, you will make the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths, to which you had not broken through earlier. It is fitting, bhikkhus, for a clansman intent on his good to accept the offer. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning, a first point cannot be discerned of blows by spears, blows by swords, blows by axes. And even though this may be so, bhikkhus, I do not say that the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by suffering or displeasure. Rather, the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths is accompanied only by happiness and joy. Therefore, bhikkhus, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the origin of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the cessation of suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Puts it in its context, doesn't it? Okay. And there's one sutta that I thought I would read on, sort of going over the, sort of again, a sort of a whole overview of basically how to be enlightened. This is Sanyutta 22, Sutta number 81. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in Kosita's park. Then in the morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking bowl and robe, entered Kosambi for alms. When he had walked for alms in Kosambi and had returned from the alms round, after his meal, he set his lodging in order himself, took his bowl and robe, and without informing his personal attendants, without taking leave of the Bhikkhu Sangha, he set out on tour alone, without a companion. This is after the quarrel at Kosambi. Then, not long after the Blessed One had departed, a certain bhikkhu approached the Venerable Ananda and told him, "Friend Ananda, the Blessed One has set his lodging in order himself, taken his bowl and robe, and without informing his personal attendants, without taking leave of the Bhikkhu Sangha, he has set out on tour alone, without a companion. Friend, whenever the Blessed One sets out like that, he wishes to dwell alone. On such an occasion, the Blessed One should not be followed by anyone." Then the Blessed One, wandering by stages, arrived at Parilayaka. There at Parilayaka, the Blessed One dwelt at the foot of an auspicious sal tree. Then a number of bhikkhus approached the Venerable Ananda and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, they sat down to one side and said to the Venerable Ananda, "Friend Ananda, it has been a long time since we heard a Dhamma talk in the presence of the Blessed One. We should like to hear such a talk, Friend Ananda." Then the Venerable Ananda, together with those bhikkhus, approached the Blessed One at Parilayaka, at the foot of the auspicious sal tree. Having approached, they paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then instructed, exhorted, inspired, and gladdened those bhikkhus with a Dhamma talk. Now on that occasion, a reflection arose in the mind of a certain bhikkhu. How should one know, how should one see, for the immediate destruction of the taints to occur? The Blessed One, having known with his own mind the reflection in that bhikkhu's mind, addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, this Dhamma has been taught to me. This Dhamma has been taught by me discriminately. The four establishments of mindfulness have been taught by me discriminately. The four right strivings, the four bases for spiritual power, the five spiritual faculties, the five powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path, has been taught by me discriminately. Because in regard to the Dhamma that has been thus taught by me discriminately, a reflection arose in the mind of a certain bhikkhu. How should one know, how should one see, for the immediate destruction of the taints to occur? And how, bhikkhu, should one know, how should one see, for the immediate destruction of the taints to occur? Here, bhikkhus, an uninstructed worldling who is not a seer of the Noble Ones and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, regards form as self. That regarding, bhikkhus, is a formation, or sankhara. That formation, what is its source? What is its origin? From what is it born and produced? When the uninstructed worldling is contacted by a feeling born of ignorance, contact, craving arises. Thence that formation is born. Thus, because that formation is impermanent, condition dependently arisen, that craving is impermanent, condition dependently arisen, that feeling is impermanent, condition dependently arisen, that contact is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen, that ignorance is impermanent, conditioned, dependently arisen. When one knows and sees thus, bhikkhus, the immediate destruction of the taints occurs. He may not regard form as self, but he regards self as possessing form. That regarding is a formation. That formation, what is it? And it goes through all of that again. Through the formation being a form, that regarding is a formation. That formation is its origin is through contact and feeling. So and when one knows and sees thus, bhikkhus, the immediate destruction of the taints occurs. He may not regard form as self, or self as possessing form, but he regards form as in self. That regarding is a formation. Through that again. He may not regard form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, but he regards self as in form. That regarding is a formation. And then it goes through, of course, all of those different four ways of holding, creating a self out of form, and applying that to feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. And then he may not regard form as self, and then through all of those permutations of creating self out of form, feeling, perceptions, volitional formations and consciousness, or self as in consciousness, but he holds such a view as this: that which is the self is the world. Having passed away, that I shall be, permanent, stable, eternal, not subject to change. That eternalist view is a formation, and then goes through all that how that formation is created. When one knows and sees thus, because the immediate destruction of the taints occurs. And he may not regard form as self through all of them, or hold such an eternalist view, but he holds such a view as this: I might not be, and it might not be for me. Might not be for me. I will not be, and it will not be for me. That annihilationist view is a formation. He may not regard form as self, and through all of those ways of creating self, eternalism, annihilationist view, or hold such an annihilationist view, but he is perplexed, doubtful, indecisive in regard to the true Dhamma. That perplexity, doubtfulness, indecisiveness in regard to the true Dhamma is a formation. That formation, what is its source? What is its origin? From what is it born and produced? When the uninstructed worldling is contacted by a feeling of ignorance, contact, craving arises. Thence that formation is born. So that formation, bhikkhus, is impermanent, condition dependently arisen. That craving is impermanent, condition dependently arisen. That feeling is impermanent, condition dependently arisen. That contact is impermanent, condition dependently arisen. That ignorance is impermanent, condition dependently arisen. When one knows and sees thus, bhikkhus, the immediate destruction of the taints occurs. And have one last sutta to read, which is in Tom Jeff's book, which is in the library. It's the leaves, number 3, volume number 3, the Anguttaras. I'm pretty sure it's 3. Describes it as an annihilationist view. last sutta. And this is, and this will complete all of my readings. This is Ankudra 8, Sutta number 80. Monks, there are these eight grounds for laziness. Which eight? There is the case where a monk has some work to do. The thought occurs to him, I will have to do this work, but when I have done this work, my body will be tired. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the first ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk has done some work. The thought occurs to him, I have done some work. Now that I have done work, my body is tired. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the second ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk has to go on a journey. The thought occurs to him, I will have to go on this journey, but when I have gone on the journey, my body will be tired. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the third ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk has gone on a journey. The thought occurs to him, I have gone on a journey. Now that I have gone on a journey, my body is tired. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the fourth ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk, having gone for alms in a village or town, doesn't get as much coarse or refined food as he would like for his fill. The thought occurs to him, I, having gone for alms in a village or town, haven't got as much coarse or refined food as I would like for my fill. This body of mine is tired and unsuitable for work. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the fifth ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk, having gone for alms in a village or town, gets as much coarse or refined food as he would like for his fill. The thought occurs to him, I, having gone for alms in a village or town, have gotten as much coarse or refined food as I would like for my fill. This body of mine is heavy and unsuitable for work, stuffed with beans, as it were. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the sixth ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk comes down with a slight illness. The thought occurs to him, I have come down with a slight illness. There's a need to lie down. So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the seventh ground for laziness. Then there is the case where a monk has recovered from his illness, not long after his recovery. The thought occurs to him, I have recovered from my illness. It's not long after my recovery. This body of mine is weak and unsuitable for work. Why don't I lie down? So he lies down. He doesn't make an effort for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized. This is the eighth ground for laziness. There are these eight grounds for the arousal of energy, which eight? There is the case where a monk has some work to do. The thought occurs to him, I will have to do this work, but when I am doing this work, it won't be easy to attend to the Buddha's message. Why don't I make an effort beforehand for the attaining of the as yet unattained, the reaching of the as yet unreached, the realization of the as yet unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the first ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk has done some work. The thought occurs to him, I have done some work. While I was doing work, I couldn't attend to the Buddha's message. Why don't I make an effort for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the second ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk has to go on a journey. The thought occurs to him, I will have to go on this journey. But when I am going on the journey, it won't be easy to attend to the Buddha's message. Why don't I make an effort beforehand for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the third ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk has gone on a journey. The thought occurs to him, I have gone on a journey. While I was going on the journey, I couldn't attend to the Buddha's message. Why don't I make an effort for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the fourth ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk, having gone for alms in a village or town, doesn't get as much coarse or refined food as he would like for his fill. The thought occurs to him, I, having gone for alms in a village or town, haven't got as much coarse or refined food as I would like for my fill. This body of mine is light and suitable for work. Why don't I make an effort for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the fifth ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk, having gone for alms in a village or town, gets as much coarse or refined food as he would like for his fill. Thought occurs to him, I, having gone for alms in a village or town, have gotten as much coarse or refined food as I would like for my fill. This body of mine is light and suitable for work. Why don't I make an effort for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the sixth ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk comes down with a slight illness. The thought occurs to him, I have come down with a slight illness. Now, there's the possibility that it could get worse. Why don't I make an effort beforehand for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the seventh ground for the arousal of energy. Then there is the case where a monk has recovered from his illness. Not long after his recovery, the thought occurs to him, I have recovered from my illness. It's not long after my recovery. Now, there's the possibility that the illness could come back. Why don't I make an effort beforehand for the attaining of the as-yet-unattained, the reaching of the as-yet-unreached, the realization of the as-yet-unrealized? So he makes an effort. This is the eighth ground for the arousal of energy. These are the eight grounds for the arousal of energy.
Okay.